entered into settlement discussions and then finally an agreement, we really separated our actions into three parts. The first part of the settlement, let me give a little more history here. In December of 2011, the district court in Minnesota adopted the settlement agreement, and then finally Judge Donovan Frank appointed a court monitor in 2012. So you'll often hear us talking about the court monitor as well, and so I wanted to provide that background. So in August of 2013, we created what is called a comprehensive plan of action. I have it, a copy of it. It contains about 104 criteria that must be met by the department if we are to be substantially compliant with the settlement agreement. I can certainly make copies available, but I didn't make the 50-page document available for today. There's a lot of detail there, but just know that we are required to meet a certain set of criteria, and they are contained in something called the Comprehensive Plan of Action. It's the path we'll take to meet our settlement requirements, and again, it created what is referred to as the Jensen Implementation Team. It's a group of people inside the agency whose job it is to make sure we are compliant with and acting on the requirements of the settlement. Again, I can make the entire comprehensive plan available to anyone who wants to see it. It is a public document. As I said, there are three parts to the settlement agreement. The first part of the settlement agreement addresses closing the facility on the Cambridge campus. So we had already ended the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options Program, the MEDO program. We had closed that already. We had not downsized to a program where we are accepting somewhere between 8 or 10 people into the program at Cambridge. And as a part of the settlement, we agreed we would close the Cambridge campus. We would no longer serve people with developmental disabilities in institutional environments. You will hear more about that when we talk about the principles of the Supreme Court decision in the Olmstead case. But the department decided it needed to take a leadership role and move away from segregated institutional environments for people with developmental disabilities. So we agreed to close that facility. Also included in part one is just a number of other systems requirements that are placed upon the department to make sure that in fact we serve members of the settlement class, that we do assessments, that we do follow-up, and that we run our systems in a way that are clearly modeled with best practices. So that's part one of the agreement. Part two of the agreement you're probably going to hear a lot about. It addresses what we refer to as the modernization of Rule 40. Rule 40 was a rule that provided providers, including the department as a provider, in the use of what we now refer to as prohibited techniques. So certain types of restraint that were allowed in the past. There are going to be changes as a result of this settlement, and the modernization of Rule 40 was really accelerated or moved ahead by the legislature with regulations in 245D of statute around home and community-based waivers. And I am certain that you will hear more about this. It's a real change in the community in how we address, treat, and serve people with developmental disabilities, and I think it's a change for all of us. But it was one of the things the department agreed to, that we would modernize this rule. And then finally, part three of the settlement agreement addresses how the state will develop an Olmstead plan and implement that plan, the driving principle being that people with disabilities have the right to live in integrated settings, to live, work, play in integrated environments. So, part one, we have closed MEDO. We are now serving people with developmental disabilities in smaller, more integrated environments, community environments, and last August we closed the Cambridge campus. The campus is still there. Obviously, the townhomes that were on campus are still there, but we are not serving clients at that program. We've transitioned to a program called LifeBridge, which is in communities, in smaller homes. We provide treatment for clients in crisis. serving generally the same population that we served historically. These are people living with developmental disabilities who also have had some interaction with the criminal justice system, have caused some kind of either damage to other people or to themselves or to the community. Courts have found that these people would be otherwise unsafe if not treated. So we still serve that population, but we do so in much more in much smaller treatment environments. Currently, we have two homes, one in Berbers Lake, one in Stratton Lake, and we will also be adding a number of other homes to serve this population. Talked already a little bit about the modernization of Rule 40. It's the rule that governs anytime we use aversive techniques or deprivation in licensed facilities. And the new rule is currently on its way to the Office of Administrative Hearings. The hearings will be held in February. That is where public comment will be made, and the Office of Administrative Hearings, the judge will rule on whether there is the statutory authority to approve the rule, and it should be finalized. The hearing will be in February. We expect a final rule by the summer, if all goes well.
Ms. Berry, we have a question from Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Deputy Commissioner Berry. My question was on the creation of the new community-based, you know, settings. And a concern has been raised in the past that those disproportionately have been in greater Minnesota, while they often serve metro origin clients and clients with a racial or ethnic background that's not necessarily representative of some of the settings that have traditionally been used in greater Minnesota. And I note that you're going to talk about one being in the South or West Metro, but how is the department doing on sort of rebalancing its specialized services so that people can be actually served close to home, where their family could come and visit, where there's, you know, transit, whether it's a Greyhound or whatever, that could get them to actually visit their loved one, that sort of thing.
Ms. Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, it's always a challenge when we try to site a facility because there are a number of factors that come into play, where a provider is available, where we are able to hire staff, where our community is receptive to the home, and then most importantly, well, I started with where people want to live, but where we can work with counties to create a place for people to live in more integrated environments. So we try to factor in all those things and build enough service capacity around the state to be as responsive as we can to those needs. Right now, we can't be as responsive as we want to because we have two facilities. They're both in the Isani County, Cambridge area, and we know that that doesn't serve the entire state. So I wish I had a simple answer to your question, but we try to factor in a number of things, including where the client wants to live and where their family is, where their guardians are, where their supports are, and I hope we collectively get better at being able to place people closer to where their supports are and where they want to live.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Berry. It's never easy. It's not easy whether you're a county. It's not easy whether you're the state, and we recognize that, but that's why the Olmstead settlement was given a priority by the Justice Department and the U.S. Supreme Court, because it is a civil right to be located close to the things that you value in your life and that we all value. And even though it's difficult, I would hope that you would actually do some demographic planning and let that guide future locational decisions, because I think the demographics in Minnesota are changing, whether we like them or not, in terms of more people being clustered in regional centers and in the metro area, and that certain ethnic and racial groups do tend to be concentrated. We're not a fully integrated state yet, even though we're becoming more diverse. And so I just really think that needs to be a priority that's reflected in the Olmstead plan and your planning. And I know the families will really appreciate it, because nothing's worse than having someone you really care about who's gone through crisis and there isn't the local resources to respond to them, and then have them so far away that you can hardly stay in contact on any regular basis.
Ms. Berry.
Mr. Chairman, and thank you. To reinforce that, the court monitor and the court has asked us exactly the same question. Would you map out geographically where these next services need to be located? And we are working with our policy area. I represent the provider side of the DHS business, but we are working closely with our policy area to make sure that, in fact, we are building and developing services where there are a need for services and where people want to live. Thank you.
Members, we have the January 21st minutes also to approve. So do I have a motion to approve the minutes? Motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Minutes approved. You may continue, Ms. Berry.
So the next part of the settlement agreement is the Olmstead Plan, and I'm going to ask Darlene Zangara to join me at the table. She is the Executive Director of the Office of Olmstead Implementation. She is responsible for reporting to the sub-cabinet under an executive order from the governor. A sub-cabinet of commissioners was created to guide the development of the Olmstead Plan. The first two parts of the Jensen settlement are really responsibility of the Department of Human Services, but when you move into a fully integrated and comprehensive Olmstead Plan, you now engage a number of other agencies in the communities who represent transportation, where people live. Many of those things are outside of the purview and responsibility of the Department of Human Services. So part of that subcabinet's responsibility is to bring together all the parts of state government that have a role in creating environments in which people can successfully live integrated lives in the community. So at this point, I will turn over responsibility for talking about the Olmstead Plan and its requirements for the state to Darlene.
Ms. Zangara, welcome to the committee. Sounds like you have a lot of responsibility in that position, so we look forward to hearing your testimony. You may begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm very excited to be here and give you an overview. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Great.
Well, maybe bring the mic a little closer to yourself.
Okay. I think it went up. Okay. Thank you.
That's okay. Oops, that's yours, sorry.
That's okay. Well, good afternoon. I am Dr. Darlene Zangara, the new executive director for the Olmstead Implementation Office, and I'm here to give you an overview of the Olmstead Plan. In 2013 in Minnesota, we had created the Olmstead Plan to improve how it served people with disabilities. It was important because approximately about 10% of Minnesotans have disability. The total is expected to grow as large as 20% as the population ages. So the percentages ranges. Unfortunately, many Minnesotans with disabilities do not have the access to the same choices and opportunities as people without disability. In fact, it can be very tough for a person with a disability to live in a place where and way it's best for them. The resources to manage their disabilities are often not realistic or unavailable. And this could terribly limit their ability, freedom, and create a big problem for our state. As you see, there's a chart on the PowerPoint. Our goal is to create a better Minnesota for all of us. Our state really cannot thrive if individuals are not able to live in a place and a way that is best for them. This is called segregation. Healthy, educated, employed, stable people are the heart of strong, respectful, thriving communities. When our community thrives, we all benefit. As you see, education, important to have good education, having opportunities for jobs, creating a strong economy. A better economy leads to a stabilization for housing, and increased stability offers opportunities to increase people's health and well-being, and that leads to better support and services to help people live, work, and get education in ways that are meaningful to them. What is Olmstead? The Olmstead vision is a plan where we can help achieve a better Minnesota. It will help Minnesotans with disabilities have the opportunity both now and the future to live close to their families and friends, to live more independently, to engage in more productive, competitive employment, and to also have a meaningful participation in community life. So how do we get there? Well, the aim of the plan is to build communities that will welcome and engage and respect people with disabilities at the highest level possible, more than before. To do that, the Olmsted Plan outlined 7 important domains in a person's life. And you'll notice the different areas that are represented. This 7 domains pretty much directed how we designed the plan. And each of the domains has a direct impact on a person's life. For example, employment. We want to see them have the opportunity for productive, competitive employment. Housing, be able to choose where they want to live and who they want to live with and where. Healthcare and healthy living, having a range of accessible services. Community engagement, meaningful connections with the community and involvement. Transportation, we all want reliable, accessible transportation. Lifelong learning and education, inclusive education experience. And last, the support services, choices to allow us to make integration successful. So each of the domains must be on track for a person to fully thrive. The plan will list all specific goals, key activities that each of these will be addressed to a specific domain. And keep in mind, we have approximately over 215 different action items that are shared among the 8 different state agencies working on this project. Accountable and effective. The Minnesota Olmsted Plan requires us to make a difference in the people's lives and in their our communities. Working hard enough is just not good enough to be successful. We need to improve the options for people with disabilities. To do this, our goals were created to be very specific, measurable, and timely. We are now beginning to measure 3 different areas. The first area is, are we seeing movement from segregated to integrated opportunities? The second area is we are getting rid of that waiting list and making sure they keep moving at a reasonable pace. And the third is, what is the overall quality of life for people with disabilities? Are they better off today than they were yesterday? All of these measurement activities will be transparent so that people can see the work and hold us accountable for it. We will measure progress over a span of time. We don't want just a quick snapshot. For example, our quality of life evaluation allows us to look at the 7 different domains areas and see, are we doing a good job of improving their quality of life? But we're also capturing different stories from these individuals to tell us, you know, more what the actual evaluation may not tell us. And looking at Olmsted, I know many individuals in our communities are a little confused. They associate Olmsted with Olmsted County. No, it's not named after the county here in Minnesota. It's actually the name of a defendant in the 1999 U.S. Supreme Court. And it is a landmark civil rights case that reached the U.S. Supreme Court, and the decision is based on the definition of the rights of people with disabilities. So improving lives is the right thing to do. It's also the law. The Olmsted Plan complies with the Minnesota Human Rights Act, which is our state law, and the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is a federal law. So both of these laws prohibit any discrimination against people with disabilities. I want to end with the Minnesota legacy. It is our legacy. We have been known historically to be a leader in the disability field. The Olmsted Plan goal is to spell out the approach to transform the people's lives with disabilities. Historically, we were a national leader, but over the years, I think our progress has faded. when we meet the plan's goal, the Minnesota will again set the highest standards for disability service in the nation. We will become a model for other states to follow. Most importantly, the goal is to improve lives with people with disabilities. And we have a complete plan on the website you're able to access. We also provided you a sample of a bi-monthly report that we submit to the court to track our progress. And you will also see there is a spreadsheet, too, that shows all of the action items listed that we are responsible for. So it's a wonderful opportunity and a collaborative effort with all of the agencies in the state of Minnesota.
Dr. Zengara, thank you for your testimony. We are very appreciative of your information and all the knowledge you've given us, so thank you. Next, I'd like to call down to the testifying table is Ms. Roberta Opheim. She is the state ombudsman for the mental health and developmentally disabilities. Ms. Opheim. Ms. Opheim, if you would state your name for the record, and after that you may begin your presentation.
Yes, Chair, members of the committee, I'm Roberta Opheim. I'm the state of Minnesota's Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, and have spent the last 21 years working to protect the civil and human rights of individuals with cognitive, mental health, developmental disabilities, and chemical dependency. Our agency in 2008 wrote a substantive investigative report about the conditions at the Meadow facility that some of the substance of the report was actually fundamental in the filing of the Jensen class action lawsuit. Because of that role and the information, knowledge, and background we had in 2012, we were appointed to be consultants to the court monitor and indirectly to the court in the Jensen Settlement Agreement. As a result, we've worked with the Department of Human Services and many other departments on all the aspects of what needs to be done to come in compliance with the settlement agreement. And so subsequently, our office and the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities, who is the other consultant to the court monitor, were appointed by the governor to be ex officio members, subject matter expertise to the Olmstead sub-cabinet. Needless to say, I not only support the plan, but believe it's critical to the health, well-being, and quality of life of Minnesota. But in addition, I frequently see situations that I know in my heart, not legally in a court of law, but I know in my heart we are not living up to the spirit and intent of the Olmstead decision, even though we are bound by the Supreme Court decision. So I'm not here to talk as much about that we all support this, all that type of thing, but I want to talk about the consequences of not doing the Olmstead and the Olmstead plan. It has a very hefty price tag, whether you're talking about a human price tag or a financial price tag. There will be costs associated to starting up some of these initiatives in the Olmstead plan, and we're all anxiously awaiting to see what the governor's going to propose in his budget. But it's not always about spending more money. One of the directives is to first look at the money you have and find better ways to spend it that are more in line with the goals. We have some laws, rules, policies, and procedures on the books that prevent, you think, well, we want to go this way. Oh, but there's this law that prevents it. Well, we need to look at all of that and say, can we take our money and use it in different ways? So we'll need to engage the legislature on that. But the other half of it is, if you don't have a plan that is measurable, verifiable, implementable, and moving at a reasonable pace, you are ripe for another federal individual or class action lawsuit against the state of Minnesota for failure to live up to the Olmstead Plan. And depending upon the circumstances of the case, those can be extremely expensive. So how does the state defend itself? It defends itself by having a plan. But the plan is not simply having a plan. And all the federal guidance says, if you don't have a plan, you're pretty much on your own to defend against an Olmstead lawsuit. But if you have a plan and you're moving at a reasonable place, because we all know human and civil rights movements don't happen overnight simply by the passing of a law. They take a long time to implement. So we have to have a plan. We have to be serious about the plan, and we have to move the plan forward if we want to defend ourselves against an outside lawsuit. And for those who think that might not be a real possibility, trust me, I have attorneys that call me and say, know of any cases that would be ripe for an Olmstead case? And I say, well, our job is to facilitate an outcome so you don't have to file an Olmstead lawsuit. So that's the area that we're working in with individual people whose rights may or may not have been violated. So not only is it the right thing to do for the humanity of the state and the people that I know enrich our lives every day that sometimes too often we just don't see because they're on the margins of life, but it's also the right thing to do to protect the state against further financial loss. With that, I would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Alpine. Members, any questions? Representative Lane.
Thank you, Chair. We have this handout here on the Olmstead Plan with deadlines. This looks like a plan to me. Could you speak to it as far as your concerns about it?
Oh, we do have a plan.
Oh, okay.
We do have a plan. We did not have a plan for the first 15 years that Olmstead was in effect. And finally, the federal government said, if you want to defend against something, you better have a plan. And I think this plan is long overdue for the state of Minnesota. While I might individually, as member of the subcabinet, agree or disagree with minute items in what you would call a plan, we have to move forward with that plan. The judge has approved the plan in general concept, but is still demanding some constant changes to it, which means he could, in the end, reject it if he doesn't like the changes. But we do have a plan. My point is it has to be implementable.
Thank you.
Representative Lane? Any other questions, member? Representative Lomer, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Opem. I'm curious about any kind of, first of all, I want to ask, am I right in understanding that with the Olmstead Plan that only four-bedroom group homes are allowed? Is that correct?
I think that that's probably a better question for some of the more technical experts, but no. We certainly have what we call institutionalized settings, and some of those would be what they call an intermediate care facility for people with developmental disabilities, nursing homes, because it includes elderly disabled. They're all considered to be institutions. There's some hallmarks of this, though. Even four-bed group homes will be considered an institution if the nature of the life of the people in those facilities is such that it's regulated totally by someone else and not, you know, free for their choice. What we are seeing happen is, and DHS can comment on this much better than I can, CMS is starting to say what they'll fund and what they won't fund with Medicaid dollars. And they're, you know, they really want people to have their own place, an apartment, a home, a family home. That's the gold standard. But the caveat is you can't move someone to a place to which they would object to be moving to. So you can't say to them, or theoretically can't say, you're out of here. If you don't want to move, if you're happy, it's about the individual freedom of choice. But CMS is routinely writing their rules to say, we're going to look at everything you do, and we're only going to fund certain things with MA dollars that meet the goals and intent of Olmstead. That's another factor that came into play.
Representative Lund, okay, thank you. There are some providers here. The counties are here to testify as well, and they also might have an answer for you, Representative. At this time, I'd like to call down the counties who would like to testify. And we have Ms. Solstrom is here, and Ms. Deline, thank you for coming. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you may begin your presentation.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Deb Schustrom with Otter Tail County Human Services, Interim Director.
And I'm Nancy Deline with Chisago County Health and Human Services.
Very good, welcome.
Thank you. First, I want to take an opportunity to say thank you for giving us a little bit of time on the agenda today to give you some perspective from the counties. Counties agree with and support the tenants' philosophy and goals of Olmstead, much like Ms. Olmheim said. And the counties want to partner with the state government agencies, not just the Department of Human Services, but the other agencies that will be involved and are involved as a part of the sub-cabinet in the work around Olmstead. We support full integration of the person into the community in all of those areas in the domains of the plan, the housing, jobs, transportation, lifelong learning and education, healthy living, community life engagement, and the support services. Counties support person-centered planning and person-centered thinking, promoting the opportunity and freedom for people with disabilities to make and have meaningful choices and self-determination that's meant to improve the quality of their life. It's about what's important to that person as well as what's important for that person. Counties recognize that there is a need for system change and infrastructure change in order to implement the tenets of Olmstead, and that needs to be done through policy and practice across the service delivery system. Some of the observations from counties would include how to develop options to provide true choice statewide, realizing that what may be available in one part of the state may not be available in another part of the state, and how do we make that happen? What are those geographic differences? How do we account for that, and how do we make for real true choice? How do we balance between meaningful choice and self-determination, the what's important to the person and what's important for the person, how to support risk, how to support health and safety? Counties also realize that there are definitely fiscal implications to the Olmstead Plan. We want to have to ask that all the state agencies be very careful in any realignment of current resources so that unintended consequences don't occur, that services that currently exist and are really doing good work to support people don't end up underfunded or limited, and that there be good assessment of new funding sources, such as expanding home and community-based service waivers, expanding use of medical assistance options, and flexibility of funding.
I'd like to start by saying I was a kid in high school that worked in the food service at Cambridge State Hospital for a good job before I went off to college. And so some of my remarks are coached with that, but counties, we have workforce issues like many other types of providers, and I would suggest or hope that as we look at the implementation of Olmstead's, because it's so important that this goes forward and goes forward well, that we look to our educational institutions to provide basic education about the tenets of Olmstead from high school, grade school, up through the professional institutions, so when folks come to our door to work, that they have that grounding before they enter our workforce, because we have so much to train that if they have that basic understanding, I think things will go better, and that the application of Olmstead is not only at the case manager level, but it's also needs to be embraced at all levels of administration. And other things I'd like to point out is that the counties expect to have some new and non-traditional partners in putting this plan forward, and we're anxious to see who those folks are, and actually we may be more partnering with what had formerly been advocacy groups than not, and it's important that we all come to common ground and to carry this through. Local emphasis on soft service development, I think, is quite important in our communities. How do we support or stimulate those supports, that'd be like chore service and community recreation and those informal supports before folks get to the more formal system of care and social services. There's a whole spectrum out there that our local tax dollars don't fund, but we're very reliant on healthy communities to make people's lives work well. I think the state's initiatives and interests in transit and broadband development are very important, and commerce. This is also a population that will benefit greatly from those developments, and so any outcomes of this session should strongly keep in mind the disability population and the tenants of this particular court action. So mirroring Deb here, we do support Homestead, and we encourage that our professional community have a good grounding in that, in addition to our other more non-traditional partners, because it's important to pull this thing together. So thank you for our opportunity to speak with you.
Ms. Shorstrom, Ms. Deline, thank you for your testimony. I'll ask if there's any questions from members for you before you leave the testifying table. Members? If none, we'll call on our next testifiers. And we have Don Levine is here with us. And Steve Larson. And Mike Burke is here. So if the three of you could come down. And for the record, please state your name. And then also you may begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Steve Larson with the ARC Minnesota, Senior Policy Director. And to my left is our Executive Director, Don Levine. And I told Don I wanted to go first, and he's a good director and listened to me, so I'm going to go first today. The ARC Minnesota provides advocacy and supports for persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities and their families. The ARC Minnesota strongly supports the Olmsted Plan. The Olmsted Plan is the voice of persons with disabilities. And what do I mean by a voice? I want to go back to what Commissioner Berry had said earlier about MEDO. MEDO was a facility that dealt with some very struggling individuals with disabilities. And their culture, unfortunately, very quickly evolved to one in which people were punished for doing what was perceived to be wrong. Punished, handcuffed, shackled. They were told not to tell anybody about what happened when they were there, or they would be punished more severely. We had one brave individual with developmental disabilities named Bradley Jansen. Bradley reported to his parents what was going on. He used his voice to articulate what he knew was wrong. His parents went to an ARC advocate at ARC Greater Twin Cities. That ARC advocate connected the family to the ombudsman's office, and Roberta Opheim and her staff took it on from there. So it's very important that persons with disabilities have a voice, their own voice, as well as the voice of the Olmsted Plan, to publicly articulate their dreams and desires for the future. The Olmsted Plan provides that voice, and it's defined some new terms, such as informed choice and person-centered planning and thinking. Informed choice is just not asking a person with disabilities to choose between this or that, but instead means that a person with a disability is given a wide variety of experiences to base their future decisions upon. It's no longer this group home or that group home, but instead it's about how individuals with disabilities can build their unique lives in the community. And one of your handouts on page 38, it has several personal stories that describe how people are moving from more segregated, both living and working situations, and I would encourage you to read those stories. The plan places a high priority on person-centered planning, which empowers persons to design their own services and supports and to meet their individual needs, dreams, and desires. The voice of persons with disabilities is further defined in the quality sections of the plan. New surveys of persons with disabilities and new opportunities for public policy planning input will be some of the components of the quality plan. In addition, the ARC Minnesota and our collaborative partners believe that the plan would be strengthened with appropriate funding for the State Quality Council. We will be actively lobbying for the funding this year, which will provide a further opportunity for all stakeholders to systematically engage in quality improvement activities across the state. Access to inclusive housing controlled by individuals with disabilities is a major challenge and opportunity. The Olmsted Plan calls for increasing the percentage of persons on public funding who have a lease or own their own home. In the past 5 years, the ARC Minnesota, with our Housing Access Services program funded by DHS, has helped close to 1,200 Minnesotans with disabilities find homes of their own where their names are on the lease. It can be done, and we look forward to working with you all on this goal. Lastly, let's use the Olmsted Plan to really give a voice to persons with disabilities by adequately funding self-advocacy. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Mr. Larson, thank you. This group is very aware of the work that you've done for the group, for the residents and the friends that we have around the Capitol that need your help, especially Kurt. It's been a joy to work with, so on behalf of the committee, we'd just like to thank you for your work and thank you for your testimony. This time, Mr. Levine, if you'd like to give your testimony, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Don Lavin.
Thank you, Mr. Lavin.
I'm the executive director of the ARC Minnesota, and I'm also a founding member of the Minnesota Employment Coalition. And I'm here to speak about the employment elements of the Olmsted Plan. We're coming off Martin Luther King National Holiday this week, and I thought I would begin by sharing one of my favorite quotes by Dr. King. Take the first step in faith. You don't have to see the whole staircase. Just take the first step. Minnesota took an historic first step to advancing employment opportunities and support of Minnesotans with disabilities when it became an employment first state on September 29, 2014. Minnesota now joins 32 states from around the country that have a formal employment first policy, directive, or governor's executive order. To many of us, this was not a surprise. Employment was rated as the highest area of community need by persons with disabilities, family members, and others during statewide listening sessions and public feedback gathered by Governor Dayton's Olmsted Subcommittee in 2013. Now, contemporary research documents that people with disabilities want to work and can contribute their skills in the competitive workforce, yet only 15 to 17% of working-age Minnesotans with intellectual and developmental disabilities who are supported by federal, state, and county-funded programs are working in integrated employment and earning at least a minimum wage. Minnesota can do much better. Investment in our new Employment First policy offers an opportunity to chart a new direction and increase the level of competitive employment participation over time. First, the Employment First policy is a required provision of Minnesota's Olmsted Plan and Jensen Settlement. It provides a clear statewide vision on the need for transformational change as well as measurable long-range goals with respect to employment. It recognizes the right of persons with disabilities to choose work, and it requires guidance to assist them in making an informed choice through helpful information and personal experiences. It establishes employment as an expectation and the preferred option, but it does not require that everyone work. It advances Minnesota in the direction of individual control of services and supports that directly impact on their lives. It requires coordinated efforts of state agencies, including uniform data collection, so the state of Minnesota can measure progress in obtaining competitive employment outcomes. And finally, it encourages innovation and investment in new ideas and practices to increase competitive employment. In closing, I'd like to say the fundamental idea of working at a job, earning as much money as one can, contributing one's skills and talents to the workforce, and becoming as independent as possible is certainly a goal that all of Minnesota can get behind. Investing in Minnesota's Employment First policy is an important first step. Thank you, and the ARC Minnesota stands ready to be of help wherever we can.
Thank you, Mr. Levin. Any questions, members? Representative Laufer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Levin, I share your values and excitement about making employment more a part of life of people with disabilities, most of whom would love and be thrilled to take home a paycheck. But I thought in glancing through the voluminous materials that I saw a definition of competitive employment that was earning $600 a month, which is, you know, less than 20 hours a week, even at minimum wage. And if that's our definition, and I couldn't find it now, I think we're dreaming too small. Most people, not all, with disabilities can work full-time and want to have the, and it opens up so many more job opportunities to them because part-time is just not the nature of most employment. And could you comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we are kindred spirits. I agree with your comments. The Minnesota Employment First policy does not speak to a specific wage level, but it does speak to earning at minimum the competitive wage, the minimum federal wage. And, you know, certainly we are working towards a situation where we want people to have a working life. We know that work, that having a working life intersects with housing, discretionary income, to live life the way you would choose. So we certainly need to work so that people are achieving, you know, a livable wage that will support their community living needs.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Levin. Mr. Burke. And for the record, please state your name.
Mr. Chairman and the committee, my name is Mike Burke. I'm an executive director of Alexandria Opportunity Center in Alexandria, Minnesota. I'm also the president of Minnesota Organization for Habilitation and Rehabilitation, or MOR is the acronym. MOR consists of 102 day training or DTH providers throughout the state. In combined, we serve over 16,000 Minnesotans with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We provide a range of services, including vocational training, community-based employment, center-based employment, volunteer activities, and a range of therapeutic and life-enhancing services. Our industry is undergoing a historic transformation as the state adopts and begins to implement its Olmsted Plan and develops a home and community-based services, or the HCBS, transition plan. In addition, we are adjusting to the challenges of an entirely new rate structure, which at this point remains riff with uncertainty. Nevertheless, Moore believes that changes will present new and exciting opportunities, which we will enthusiastically embrace so long as the best interest of Minnesotans with disabilities remains in focus. The Olmsted case stands for the proposition that community-based employment opportunities should be available to all persons with disabilities. More members fully support Olmsted, and we are committed to ensuring that people with disabilities have a range of opportunities to meet their individual needs. While we support the principles embodied in the Olmsted case, we have concerns in how the Minnesota Olmsted Plan will be implemented. More strongly advocates person-centered planning, which is intended to give people with disabilities more control over their programs and the services that they receive. At its core, it is recognized that each individual is in the best position to know what he or she needs and what experiences he or she will need in their life. There are many policies and rules which impede the choices of individuals and our ability to support their choices. We are glad to see that the Olmsted Plan includes a review of these policies which do not support the notion of services in a most integrated setting. The Olmsted decision, as interpreted by the U.S. Attorney General, requires states to administer services, programs, and activities in the most integrated setting appropriate to the needs of the qualified individuals with the disabilities. While Moore supports creating more community-based work opportunities, those opportunities should not come at the expense of the current services. These programs have served our clients and their families well and should continue to be an option until new flexibility is provided across the entire system to serve all people regardless of the level of their need. While not expressly stated in the plan, some are using the Olmsted and the state's Olmsted plan as an excuse to shut down center-based programs. Many families of these people we serve, especially those with significant and complex needs, finalist message disconcerting, to say the least. With the advent of the Olmsted Plan and subsequent goals for transformational change, we are receiving a message that somehow providers are the problem rather than the solution. Throughout the history of community-based services, our organizations are the ones who have developed services to meet the needs of people we serve. We did this at the request of the state and the local agencies and have consistently met the goals and outcomes requested of us. We welcome the opportunity to continue to assist people with disabilities in finding competitive employment and challenge the state to remove the barriers both in policy, licensing rule, and funding levels that limit the ability of providers to meet the goals of Olmsted. Finally, I wish to express our commitment to the 16,000 people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and to many others that we serve throughout other programs. We have consistently made every effort to serve them in our communities through employment, volunteerism, and other types of services, while also being committed to their safety and well-being. We want to work alongside you and assist you in this transformational process to improve the lives of people with disabilities. Thank you for the opportunity.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Burke. Members, any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Burke, maybe I missed it. When you talked about specific policy barriers, could you give us those specifics, or even at a later date, could you provide us with those specific barriers that you'd like to see changed when it comes to policy?
I think the Moore organization will be providing you with those barriers as time comes. We're in the stage right now where Olmsted is not new, but the process or the rolling out of Olmsted and how that process is going to go is relatively new, and we think that there are some system problems that could create natural barriers or unnatural barriers, depending on how you look at it, that could really affect how the plan rolls out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Burke, I have a question as well. If you're not able to answer that, that's fine. Perhaps someone behind you could. In bringing some of the residents to the new homes, I noticed in the Olmsted plan is to integrate them into the community. Hopefully they're close to their family and friends, be an active part of the community, both in employment and then to the civic groups or, you know, the whole part of the community. In the Olmsted plan, and particularly in the MLB homes, both at Roseburg's Lake and Stratton Lake, and then the new additional homes, will those residents, will they be closer to their family and friends that are being transferred over?
I'm not a residential provider, so first of all, I was probably speaking in an area that I'm not comfortable with, but I would say that in general, there are vocational services being provided in every county in the state of Minnesota of some sort. And so it's important to remember that as part of that whole where you're going to live is also the fact that along with where you're going to live is where you're going to work. So I think our group really is focused on providing that most competitive, community-based, as far as we can go, but continuing to remember that we want to focus on the person-centered plan, looking at what is best for each individual. We're unable to provide one solution that's going to work for 16,000 individual people. We need to look at what's best for each one.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. I also noticed that Ms. Berry is here. You could probably answer that as well. Ms. Berry?
Mr. Chairman, Ann Berry, Deputy Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Human Services. For the Minnesota Life Bridge, the MNLB homes that are being created, we're trying to create enough of them across the state so that we can keep people as close to home as possible. They're treatment homes. These are for people who have experienced a crisis, can no longer stay where they are, or they're coming from a hospital or maybe from a jail and don't have a home to go back to. So they are treatment homes. We don't want to create hundreds of them, or we're trying to responsibly manage the number that we develop, but we're also trying to get some statewide geographic spread so that people don't have to travel far, because people aren't going to live in the treatment homes forever. They'll be there for treatment, and then they'll either go back to a home, or we'll work with counties and others to develop a new place.
Thank you, Ms. Berry. Just a follow-up question. In determining either employment or close to their family and friends, I would presume the latter would be the case in deciding which home they would go to.
Mr. Chairman, their choice would be the first thing, where they want to live and being close to family members. As you've heard, we have employment opportunities across the state. The department is also in the business in a very, very small way of providing day programs and employment programs for some of the clients we serve. But for the most part, I would say they are very, very spread across the entire state, and in almost any county or community, you would be able to find either competitive employment opportunities or day programs. We're a part of building some of those as well.
Very good. Thank you. We have some more testifiers I'd like to call down from the counties. Thank you, Mr. Burke.
Thank
Any
you.
Questions, members, at this point? Also in your packet, members, you will find written testimony, from Jan Strauss and then also from Altair is in the packet for you for your information. So members, we have Ann Henry, Bruce Nelson, and Joan Wilshire. So please introduce yourself and the organization you're with for the record.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center at the Legal Aid Society. We represent children and adults with significant, often long-term disabilities across the state. These would include people with significant mental illnesses, brain injuries, physical disabilities, as well as intellectual and developmental disabilities. We have been very supportive of our state developing an Olmstead plan with measurable goals to improve the opportunities for our clients to live and work in their communities, consistent with that Olmstead decision. We have specifically urged that the Department of Human Services make changes to various policies and funding rules in order to better align their policies with the goals that our state has for people with disabilities to be included in their community and as independent as possible. We think that we have a lot of good examples of services and providers in our state which now support people consistent with the Olmstead Decree to live and work in their communities. But we do find that these opportunities are not available consistently across the state, so we have plenty of work to do. We also agree with some of the comments of the Ombudsman, Roberta Opheim, that we do need to make some investments. We are trying to change, you just heard about that from the previous speaker, and in order to really accomplish that, we will need to invest. But we think that those investments will definitely pay off. You are well aware of our aging society and the admonitions of the state demographer about our need for more workers. We think that this population of people with disabilities holds some of those answers, and we should not ignore that. And the Olmstead plan offers us a great opportunity to assure that everyone who can work to the maximum extent possible and increase their earnings. I have a handout and also a chart that goes with it, and I'll just quickly mention four topics, and these are specific to DHS. We made other recommendations for other state agencies involved. The first one is that we think that the state has to remove the impoverishing eligibility criteria for medical assistance for persons with disabilities and seniors. This is a rather complicated matter if you're not familiar with it. The chart from the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities tries to display this. Suffice it to say, the people with disabilities and seniors are left at the bottom of the pile in terms of MA eligibility for the income level that they can have and the assets. And Representative Zerwas is going to be introducing legislation on this, so we expect we'll have an opportunity to learn and to discuss more about this. The second issue regarding healthcare eligibility is for a program called Medical Assistance for Employed Persons with Disabilities. A much smaller segment of the population of people with disabilities use this, about 8,500 people. Unfortunately, they had some pretty stiff premium increases imposed on them in October of last year. Now, that was not passed last year. It was passed in 2011. So I know a lot of members may have heard from folks affected, and you didn't pass it last year. It was passed as part of a budget deficit deal, and we hope that that premium can be repealed and put back to where it was before that deficit budget year of 2011. The second area is we think DHS can do a lot to change what they're paying for in terms of employment under their home and community waiver programs. And we also encourage them to allow people who are willing to self-direct their services to use more of the money that otherwise we're going to pay for them. We find that folks can often find individualized or more creative options for the integrated day and employment services. The third area is housing. The Department of Human Services uses the Group Residential Housing Fund to pay for a lot of housing. And we would like to see that fund used for more housing subsidies directly to people with disabilities so they can choose where they want to live. And the fourth area is in long-term services and supports. We've had a persistent waiting list for several of the waivers. And yet, year after year, money goes unspent at the county level while the waiting list continues. We believe that the department could increase its oversight and do a better job of managing those resources so that people who need the services can get them within the year where there is money available. The second area is our PCA program, which is going to transfer to another name called Community First Services and Supports, apparently by January 16, according to the department. This program is not really open to people with mental illnesses or who have other cognitive limitations who don't need physical assistance. And we think that should change because some people to mental illness simply need daily help to remain as independent as possible at home. And finally, again, to self-direction. More people are willing to do that, but the system right now does not allow folks to use the money we otherwise spend on them. So we think let's let folks find the services and be more creative on an individual basis. So thank you.
Ms. Henry, thank you. I have a question for you. In looking at the whole person's life during in regards to the Olmsted Plan, some of these goals seem to be pretty easily attainable, employment, although challenging. Employment, housing, health care, transportation, lifelong learning, support and services. I think those are easily attainable goals, and I know it's certainly working in my county, and particularly my city of Delano, which I was a member of the Dells home. I was part of their executive board or their board of directors, and my cousin Tom Early lives there. And I know the importance of those who have disabilities and engaging them in the community and what a joy it is for them to be a part of the community, but more so for us who are there, us members who are either on the councils or in businesses or in the sports or teachers. They really add a quality of life unsurpassed than anything else. So I understand and recognize, I think we all do, the importance of them engaging in the community and being part of the community, going to the football games and the basketball games, seeing them at church and at church functions. Very important in all of our towns, and I know I've witnessed it in my hometown. So the question is, what is the plan to have them engaged in the community? That's part of the plan. That's in the top of the diagram here, if you look at that. So, and that requires time, that requires staff, and money to get, and that really enhances their quality of life in addition to, clothing and the house and transportation and employment. But what are the goals to achieve that, the community involvement?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I can easily answer that, except to say one thing that we have seen really is very helpful for people's community participation is as they do participate more and more in community activities with whatever, their church, civic organizations, sports, as you mentioned, people get friends. Just like everyone else. And the more folks that you have that aren't paid to be with you, we think the more support you can have and the better life you have. And so when we don't group people in such large numbers in such separate settings, those community connections can really increase for people, and we think, as you say, everyone is better off because of it.
Thank you. I certainly agree. I think we all would agree on that. Representative Zerwas has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to thank Ms. Henry and the Disability Law Center of Minnesota for highlighting what we're going to be trying to do this session around MA reform and looking at that spend down. I think that's something that is such a complex issue, and as I've started to learn about it over the last 12 to 18 months, and just understanding what a burden it is for the sickest and poorest among us to then say, if you make a dollar over the federal poverty guideline, we're going to ask you to spend down to 75%, so spend down to $730 a month for your income, and then that asset limit that hasn't been increased since the early 80s to prevent people from developing any type of safety net, so that, heaven forbid, a sick person in poverty has a hot water heater go out and needs tires on their car, or has a medical emergency, where we're keeping them at the brink of poverty. And then when you look at the MAPD program that then punishes people for working, we should not have anything in a state system that disincentivizes people that want to work from working. And it's a huge ask. It's a heavy lift. I look forward to having the conversation this session, and really, what can we do to dig in and do meaningful reform around MA spend down? I think the time is now for us to hunker down and take a look at this issue. So thanks again, Ms. Henry, for raising it in front of this committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Zerwas. If that's your bill, sign me on. I want to be on that one.
We can certainly make that happen.
Representative Hamilton?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think Representative Zerwas just addressed my question. However, I want to be absolutely clear on this, and forgive me for being a little naive. I had attended a town hall meeting, right, and it was specifically with individuals with disabilities, and one of the biggest concerns that they had, in their words, not mine, they said, we want to be contributing members to society. We want to work. However, they were hitting the thresholds, these thresholds, and basically they were had to make the choice of either being thrown off of programs that were extremely helpful for them or you know, quit their job. And so is this the bill, Representative Zerwas, is this the bill that would address that issue to help them out so that they can continue working? I just want to make sure that I'm clear on that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hamilton, I think there are probably two bills, and I'm not exactly certain, but I think we have heard from a lot of people using that work incentive medical assistance program, medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities, called MAEPD. And because of the premium increases that were imposed in October, again, passed in 2011, but delayed because of the Affordable Care Act, had to wait until that came into effect. Those folks, we've heard from some who can't manage their van payments, and that's how they got to work. They're living very close to the margin. So it could well be folks affected by that premium increase in October, but it also could be this very harsh spend down, which takes away basically people's Social Security down to $730 a month.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Representative Liebling has a question. Representative Liebling?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I just wanted to say to Representative Zerwas, I'm really with you on this spend-down thing, and I have a bill in as well, and I'm finding out there are a lot of ins and outs to it that it isn't really what I had intended it to be, and I'm kind of working with this whole issue, which, as you know, is actually kind of complicated in how you get these pieces to fit. But I'm really glad that you're so passionate about this, because I really am too, and I know a lot of us are. So, you know, but there was something that Representative Zerwas said that I just wanted to check with Ms. Henry, because I think that you were saying that the MAEPD actually disincentivizes people from working. And I guess this kind of goes to Representative Hamilton's question as well, but I sort of thought that the MAEPD program as such kind of did the opposite, that it, maybe you just misspoke, but that it this is the program to try to allow people mm-hmm. with disabilities to work and build up some assets at least and have the advantage of being able to have medical assistance because they have needs that could not otherwise be met through probably regular insurance. So I want to get Ms. Henry to answer that if she would.
Oh, okay, Ms. Henry.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities is a work incentive program. I think the problem perhaps that Representative Zerwas was referring to is that steep premium increase. People do live close to the margin. They have their budget set. And then in October, some people had to pay $200 more a month. And that simply was a work disincentive in a work incentive program. And that's what we hope can be dealt with, too.
Right. And Mr.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, just to follow up with that, and thank you, you know, these are complicated programs, and even those of us who've been here a while and think about this stuff, it's really hard to, we've complicated these things so much, and then under the ACA where we've expanded medical assistance for more people, these are some pieces that didn't get all ironed out in that process, so I'm glad that we're all kind of on the same page. But I wanted to put a little more context around this because Ms. Henry is being very politic about this, about how this all happened. But just as we move forward, when we talk about growing costs in our health and human services and our state budget, and we're talking about in the last couple of years where, you know, we were in a surplus situation. But we still didn't have a lot of money in HHS. As some of you may remember, we actually had a small cut to our target and tried to work around that. But then the 2 years before when the GOP was in charge in the House and the Senate, when the motto was of some, not everybody, of course, was not a penny more. And I have the poster in my office, not a penny more. Well, we have to remember that we've got a growing population. We've got more people with disabilities. Medical costs are going up. We've got things like the Olmstead Plan where we need to provide for people and that we're always in a situation of balancing what money is available and what would we all really like to do for people. But I just kind of want to lay this out because this cut and this increase in the premiums that Ms. Henry is telling us about were the result of that cut philosophy and what happened. And when you say we are not going to raise a penny more, there's enough there, sometimes this is what you're doing. You're hurting some people that you really don't want to hurt. And there are tons of unintended consequences all over our budget. We know that. This is really too complicated for any of us to be absolutely sure what we're doing, no matter what we do. But I just want to kind of raise the caution flag for all of you now that you're going to be writing a budget, and it's great that we've got a surplus situation, but just kind of be careful with the rhetoric sometimes because, really, these people who are now complaining about the increase in their premiums, and some of whom are very seriously impacted, you know, the GOP did pass those cuts. And, you know, none of us really want the consequences of that. So I just want to lay that out there. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. I have that poster, too. $34 billion, not a penny more. So after spending $34 billion, if we can't ensure that every dime is spent efficiently and effectively for those who are most need and most vulnerable, then we're not doing something right here. And that was the goal of the GOP and I, my freshman year and many here, to do make sure that every dollar we take from the taxpayers is spent very efficiently, effectively, and not wasted. And I know that's what you've been working for, too. All these programs are very complex, as you said, and we wanted to ensure that they were taken care of and they were handled efficiently and effectively and helping the people who need help and yet being responsible in our fiduciary fashion. So you're right, Representative Liebman, it is very complicated. We all do our best, and we all are helping work toward a better Minnesota. Representative Zerwas has something to say.
Mr. Chair, thank you. No, and I think it's I think Representative Liebman brings up a point, and I think this is going to be a very difficult task to accomplish. It comes with a significant amount of reform and a pretty significant price tag. I think the only way to make it even more difficult is to repeatedly inject politics into it. And so I think as we focus on those that we're trying to serve and those that we're trying to help, the very neediest and poorest Minnesotans. My ask throughout this entire process is that we take the politics as much as can be done out of it. And I know Republicans did something 2 years before I got here, and Democrats did something 2 years ago. Our goal should be looking out 10 years and what can we do to help Minnesotans. And so it's going to be expensive. It's going to be a lot of reform. It's a very, very tough issue. And the only promise I can make this committee and our health policy committee is the only way to make that super tough job impossible is if we make it political. And so please, let's just do what's right. Let's campaign in the summer.
Well said, Representative Zerwas. We have three more testifiers and members that would like to speak. So and just remember, we are going to be adjourning at 2:30. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to call on, who's in order here, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I, too, have a poster in my office. And it says, Wanted Out of Office. And it has my picture on it because it says I voted for the largest tax increase in the history of Minnesota. And that was the veto override in 2008. And Representative Liebling, maybe you also remember the amendment that was passed when Speaker Kelleher was on the House floor, and it was initially offered up by Representative Bly. And Representative Bly did a very nice speech, and then he withdrew the amendment, said we cannot afford it. I crossed off his name and wrote Hamilton on the top and sent it back up to the chief clerk. And when it came to a vote, Speaker Kelleher held it open, and all the red votes turned green except for two. The Chair of Health and Human Services Finance, which was Chair Huntley, and the Chair of Health and Human Services Policy, which was Chair Thiessen. And when it was all said and done, it saved the disabled community from about $50 million in cuts that was being proposed by the majority party at the time. And so, like Representative Zerwas said, there's enough blame to go around. We are here to do what's right and hear from the testimony from the individuals that are testifying and do some good work. So I appreciate the time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Sometimes when you mention the past, it opens up wounds. Perhaps we can refrain from opening up the past at times. Representative Loeffler. I'm sorry, Representative Loeffler.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's more important that we hear from the people who came to testify. I was just going to highlight some attention to the waiting list, which is over 5,000 people, but we can talk about that another day.
Well, we don't have 5,000 people to testify, but we do have Ms. Joan Wilshire, who thank you for your patience, by the way. And for the record, please identify yourself and your organization, and you may begin with your testimony.
Yep. Good afternoon, members. My name is Joan Wilshire. I'm the executive director of the State Council on Disability. NISCOD is a state agency that was established in 1973 to advise the governor, state legislators, state agencies, and the public regarding disability issues per statute 256.48. We've been working on Olmstead issues really since 2005 when we created the Options 2, that's TOO, report, which was really developed by several state agencies in the disability community. So this is something that's been on our strategic plan for umpteen years. Now, as we look to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the ADA this coming July 26th, we must really remember that Olmstead is the result of the Title II section of the Americans with Disabilities Act here, and which requires the placement of persons with mental disabilities in community settings, living in community settings rather than in institutions. And I think when you're looking at Olmstead and the ADA right now, especially this year for the 25th anniversary, Olmstead is really one of the highlights of the ADA and one of the great successes. So that's something we should really be proud of, the fact that we're ADA is doing what it was thought out to be. Now, the council has a few recommendations about the plan, as we do support having an Olmstead plan here in the state of Minnesota. County continuity. Services across counties are not consistent. Where you live should not determine the services available to you. If a Minnesotan with a disability chooses to live independently in greater Minnesota, they need to have supports to do so. This means access to transportation, employment, housing, outdoor recreation activities, trails, hunting, etc., and community activities and medical services. This is just a short list of inclusive lifestyle. The Olmstead Plan aims to do this, but it's not quite there yet. Community engagement. We are concerned that people with disabilities and their families have not received timely and adequate information to process and act upon proposed changes in how they work, live, and play. People with disabilities need to be engaged in this process, and we need to be doing a better job of that. Employment. As we move forward with employment first initiatives in Olmsted, we must remember that discussions need to occur with people with disabilities, their families, employers, and employers about the different employment opportunities existing in for future generations of Minnesota. The Olmsted plan needs to be interwoven with existing and future state agency plans. Continued emphasis from the Olmsted plan perspective needs to happen in order for solid outcomes to take place. And finally, structure of the OIO. Structure of the OIO, Olmsted Implementation Office, should be a standalone agency, not under another large agency. The OIO needs independence to make sure that agencies abide by the court decisions. The last thing Minnesota needs is more court cases and settlements. The Department of Justice has stated that the Olmsted decision is equal to the Brown versus Board of Education case. It is the law. We must integrate people with disabilities. The Department of Justice has no shortage of litigation being brought against states, facilities, and providers around the country. Minnesota has been a leader in protecting the civil rights of people with disabilities. And finally, the Olmsted decision should not be viewed by our state agencies as a burden, but rather an opportunity to integrate people with disabilities into our society and tap into the resources they may offer the state of Minnesota. And that's my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Wilshire. Any questions for Ms. Wilshire? If not, we'll go to Mr. Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Bruce Nelson with ARM. We are a statewide association of providers, residential providers, group homes, in-home, and various other settings that we're all trying to move toward, and apartments and whatnot. In the four disability waivers, DD waiver, CADI waiver, CAC, and BI, and ICFMR, our mission is to lead the advancement of community-based services to support people in their pursuit of meaningful lives. And Olmsted-like initiatives have been long part of what we've been trying to do here and at this witness table over the years. I would, if I may, Mr. Chair, and I know time is limited, but I really do want to underscore a couple of things that were said before me because they're so important. Representative Loomer, when she asked about four-bed group homes, Ms. Opheim got up and talked about the key is freedom of choice. And I really want to underscore that. It's not my choice for other people. It's not your choice. It's nobody's professional judgment about choice. It's the person's choice, supported by those who are closest to that individual. And I worry that we often get away from that premise, and we've got to stick to that, that it's the freedom of their choices, the people whose lives are at stake. Mr. Larson talked about a voice and a wide variety of voices to develop services and not just pick between one thing and another thing. And not this model or that model, and that's your choice. And as we move forward, to make sure we have flexibility and how we're evolving services for people, not to just create another model as another choice, but to open it up for people to create their own models and providers to adapt to the needs and wants of people. And as we move forward, it's a new way of thinking, and it's wonderful, and we should do that. Mr. Chair, you did say something about people will they be able to live closer to home? Home, I presume, is like mom and dad. I want to get back to, we must have a system as we move forward that continues to and further enhances people's ability to make those choices so that they have an array of services they can choose from if they want to be near mom and dad. That's really essential. Going back a few years, I mentioned how ARM has been involved in Olmsted type of decisions or reforms, if you will. Representative Schumacher in 2012 carried some ARM legislation that opened up technology. Technology is something we have to move forward with. We all know the crunch on the workforce and the diminishing workforce and the people are getting older. We have to have monitoring technology to enable people, if they want to move out of a group home, to be able to have that technology to provide those supports for people. It's essential, and it works, and it's going to be cost-saving within the home. part of what we did in 2012, and we need to continue doing it, this discussion around GRH and housing assistance. We broke down a barrier that confined people to live in group homes because that's what group residential housing paid for. We opened it up to shelter needy, and now we're moving into housing. I get animated housing assistance, and it's wonderful we keep moving forward in that direction. We passed legislation in 2012 to allow people to voluntarily close group homes so people can move. And you're giving me the angst side, Mr. Chair, so why don't I just say, I do get worked up. This is so exciting. But we want to make sure that there's a couple potential red flags and around housing options to make sure we continue to have a safety net for people. You know, some choices might not work. That we have that. We want to make sure that, why don't I just jump ahead? There are a lot of costs. We've talked about resources that are going to be needed for people as they make other choices and needed for providers. And when we move further on, I'd like to come back, some of them have already been brought up, about the resources that we need to invest in the system and not just to make, help providers, but to help providers to support people in their needs as they transition into the lives that they want. With that, Mr. Chair, I stand for questions.
Mr. Nelson, thank you very much for your good work. I'm very aware, and a lot of us are very aware of the hard work that you do for many people, and thank you. Mr. Mitchell, I do apologize on the behalf of the committee. We simply ran out of time. However, because this is, as Mr. Opine said, the first step on the Olmsted Plan, we will have another meeting in which we will give you ample opportunity to present your video, and please accept my apologies. I must have lost control of my meeting and didn't allow you the time. So, members, if there's no further business of the committee, we have to be out of this room by 2:30 precisely. And, Mr. Mitchell, you have my word. We'll invite you back to address this issue. This meeting is adjourned.